The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
He got hit?
He got yes. Hit.
Oh my God, okay, take care of him. There's paramedics outside.
Police arrested Daryl Brooks not far from the scene. Brooks has a lengthy police record and was out on bail on two criminal cases, including a charge that he deliberately ran down a woman with his car. The victims range in age from 52 to 81. Virginia Sorensen, Leanna Owen, Tamara Durand, Jane Coolidge, and Wilhelm Hospel. A number of children are in hospitals in critical or serious condition, and Main Street is a crime scene.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that story continues to make headlines, and what a tragedy it is. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. It's great to be here with you today. The news about the attack on the Waukesha Christmas Parade is becoming increasingly disturbing. And if you have not followed this or you haven't caught the latest, let me bring you up to speed. Daryl Brooks, he was the individual who was out on $1,000 of bail. A lot of people decrying that incredibly low bail. They let him out after he assailed the mother of his child at a gas station, including trying to run her over with his vehicle. Waukesha Police Chief Daniel Thompson, he put to rest rumors that Brooks was fleeing from police after getting caught up in a knife fight. That was one of the initial rumors that came up. He said, hey, that's just not true. It's just not true. Some reporters, they found social media posts that Brooks allegedly put up that rail against whites and Jews and expressed frustrations with the verdict of Kyle Rittenhouse's trial. But Brooks, his actions allegedly, you know, they took the lives of five people, including that of somebody you might know, Tamara Durand. I know many of you may be familiar with Dave Durand. He's a regular guest on this network, had his own show here, a great contributor and just a really wonderful man. I've known Dave Durand for a while. You might not know Tamara, although she was one of those dancing grannies at 52 years of age. And I just can't imagine what Dave is going through today. So I would ask you to pray for the Durand family. Gosh, I just can't imagine. You know, you go to a parade to participate in something joyful, and the next thing you know, you're losing your life. So what can you do? What can I do right now for the Durand family? We can pray for the repose of her soul. And that's the best thing I think we can do. We can pray for Dave. And we can pray for his family, for their children. You know, they're going to be going through a lot in the next few weeks, and I don't envy that position at all. Tamara, of course, was not the only Catholic hurt there. All four parishes in the city were participating in this parade and had people hurt in the incident, including one of their priests and several school children. And it's a tough situation because as Catholics and as Christians, we're called to forgive those who so deeply wound us. Now, I know sometimes it takes time and it takes a little bit of distance, but let's pray for this perpetrator, but especially let's pray for the victims and their family. What a horrible time for this to happen, you know, on the eve of Thanksgiving and on the eve of Christmas. So tough time of year. In New York, there is some other destruction taking place. This is something, look, I've been following. I'll talk to you a little bit more about this, maybe at the end of the broadcast too, if I have some time. You know, when it comes to our culture and our heritage, we live in a strange time, don't we? The New York City Council, they decided to remove a plaster statue of Thomas Jefferson from their chambers. Why? Because he owned slaves. You know, we know Jefferson, you know, he had affairs with some of his slaves. He owned them. Nobody is condoning that type of behavior. Jefferson, of course, so eloquently penned our founding documents, you know, that Declaration of Independence and Bill of Rights, just wonderful, you know, what we have. Yet a statue that has stood 187 years, you know, it took the council just a vote without any public input, and it's now being removed. The New York Post found out about it. They reported on it last month. Then when it came to removing it, the head of the Public Arts Commission tried to keep the reporters from recording it, but ultimately relented after the mayor's office intervened. But the statue is a copy of an original bronze in the Capitol Rotunda in D.C., and it, which has been removed to the New York Historical Society, where it's going to be in the lobby in the reading room there. But let me share a little bit more. Here's some from ABC News on the matter.
Statue of Thomas Jefferson at City Hall in Lower Manhattan was again at the center of attention today. The issue is whether to remove it because of Jefferson's ties to slavery.
Outside City Hall, there was talk about Thomas Jefferson and the statue of the founding father that has stood inside the city council chamber for more than 100 years.
Yes, happened for historical purposes, but not necessary for City Hall. Just for education.
I don't think that at this place and time that it should be there.
Because while Jefferson may have pushed for the Bill of Rights, he also owned 600 slaves. And last year, during the reckoning on social injustice, a new call to remove the statue. Today, the city's Public Design Commission heard debate on the issue and ultimately voted to do so and remove the statue from the chamber. Todd Fine, a historian, submitted a letter signed by 15 other historians suggesting it be moved to the governor's room at City Hall.
It was a gift to the city by a Jewish naval officer in honor of Jefferson's position on religious freedom. It should stay in the building.
Other ideas include moving it to a public library or moving it to the New York Historical Society.
This is cancel culture at its worst.
But for Councilman Joseph Borelli of Staten Island, this is a slippery slope.
I wish this would go to some sort of a referendum or polling, because I think the majority of New Yorkers would disagree with this. I think the Bill of Rights, for example, has worked out pretty well for New Yorkers over the past 225 years.
Quite a bit of impassioned testimony during today's public debate. And while the Public Design Committee ultimately voted unanimously to remove the statue from the chambers, it will need to meet again to determine where the statue ends up.
So here's my thought on that. I don't want to belabor it. We've talked about some of these statue removals in the past. In 2020, 2021, in 2022, we don't celebrate Washington or Jefferson or any of our founding fathers who were slave owners. You know, I look back at Washington as a general who fought and who led our struggle for independence, who became the first president of this great nation. They risked everything for the freedoms and the liberties that you and I enjoy, for this great experiment in order to liberty. You know, somebody had the clout, the support to seize power for life, who set this extraordinary example of giving up power. Washington gave up power after two terms in office. He peacefully transferred it to his successor. You don't see that in any other nation. You did not see that in any other nation. And it was Jefferson who articulated, I think, one of the most eloquent cases for liberty ever written. It was Jefferson's words, if you think about this, that actually inspired abolitionists. They inspired civil rights leaders. They inspired freedom fighters. You know, and despite, of course, fierce political rivalries, when he became president, he never pursued the sort of violent reprisals that came, became a trademark of other revolutions. Now, we have to really think about where we are when we want to erase our history. Slavery is wrong. It's a dark chapter in our nation's history. It's one of the original sins. But if the standard becomes get rid of them, whoever sins, get rid of them, right? We can't honor the good that they did. I mean, somebody made a comment about Martin Luther King Jr., not quite the same as Jefferson. He didn't own slaves, of course, but he was not faithful. He broke the vows of his marriage. He cheated on his wife. I mean, do you take down statues of somebody like that? No, you don't eradicate the good and the sacrifice that these men did because of their human flaws. You know, there's no way to establish any sort of shared history. And I don't mean to go off on a tangent there, but when I hear these stories, it's crazy. Then on the flip side of this, just something that really irked me, I try not to talk about what a lot of Catholic institutions are doing, but I've got to bring this out. And I've got guests all the time on from Catholic University of America, but I'm scratching my head on this story. They're rewriting of, the history and art. An artist named Kelly Lattimore came up with an icon-style painting called Mama. You know, it's like a Pietà-like painting. And the image of the dead Christ, guess who it looks like? Guess who it's modeled after? Guess who it is? It looks just like George Floyd. Yeah. So an image of Christ in this art is George Floyd. There are two paintings, one on the campus ministry office. The other is outside of the Mary Mirror of Justice Chapel, the law school. And the artist in the interview with a Christian Century said that he's been asked whether it is Jesus or George Floyd. And you know his answer to the question is? Yes. What a clever response, right? Is it Jesus or is it George Floyd? Yes. One student there pointed out that despite the injustice of his death, I mean, George Floyd is not Jesus. I mean, the man was murdered. Jury of his peers found that to be the case. No question about it. It was horrific. But George Floyd is not Jesus Christ. He is not a saint nor a martyr. And to compare him to the sinless Son of God, personally to me, that's a disservice to the truth. And I'm sorry, but it just, it irks me. It irritates me. Tear down statues of Jefferson and Washington and Columbus and Juniper Serra. You know, let's highlight and replace Jesus Christ with George Floyd. You talk about disorientation. I've never seen anything like it. You know, I think the pendulum will swing back. We can only go so far in this direction. We can only go so far. And that is ultimately my hope. It really is. That's my hope here. Speaking of some of the wackiness out there, the Build Back Better Act, I want to talk about that for just a quick second. $1.75 trillion bill, right, that the House passed and which is waiting for a vote in the Senate. It's apparently loaded right now with provisions paying for abortions. Representative Chris Smith, he's a Republican from New Jersey, good guy, have a lot of respect to him. Great champion of the oppressed, too. He's emphasizing how, you know, the BBB would ultimately force upon states the taxpayer funding of abortion. That means you will pay for abortions. Listen to what he said.
The U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops said it is completely unacceptable that the Build Back Better Act expands taxpayer funding of abortion and many new and expanded programs. The National Right to Life Committee has pointed out that even the Obamacare contained a provision that specifically permitted states to ban elective abortion in their exchanges. The BBB, starting in 2024, would explicitly override the laws of those states. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Biden once said that those of us who are opposed to abortion should not be compelled to pay for them. This bill coerces us to pay for abortion on demand. Unborn babies, Mr. Speaker, need the President of the United States, members of Congress, and there to be their friend and advocate, not powerful adversaries subsidizing their violent destruction.
Again, Congressman Chris Smith, I'm delighted he served as long as he has and as eloquent as he is. According to Tom McCluskey, who's Director of Government Affairs at CatholicVote.com, I heard that he was saying that there's mandated abortion funding for states that don't want to expand their Medicaid coverage. There's $30 billion for different insurance plans without any restrictions on abortions. And a massive increase in funding for Obamacare exchange plans that cover abortion. Why do we worship at this altar? What is it? Why is this so holy? Why is it so sacrosanct to so many people? I mean, look at this. Look what the government is doing. $30 billion. $30 billion for different insurance plans without any restrictions on abortions. Mandated abortion funding for states that don't want to expand Medicaid. There's a massive increase funding for the Obamacare exchanges that cover abortion. $21 billion in health-related grants to states without any abortion restrictions. You know, I pray to God. Pray for the Senate. You know, I'll leave with this note on this theme here. Pray for the Senate, would you? Pray that they don't pass this bill. I wish we had more men and women in office who valued and respected life. While you're at it, we are closing in. We're wrapping up the month of November in the year 2021. Can you believe that? We're going to be knocking on December's door. And in 8 days, the Supreme Court is going to be hearing a case that is one of the most momentous in history. I think it's one of the biggest of its history. I really do. It's Dobbs versus Jackson's Women Health Organization, right? You're going to hear a lot more about this. I'll give you more coverage next week and leading up to it. This is monumental. We've been praying the rosary every evening with Father Rocky at 7 p.m. Central for an end to abortion. We're in a 450-day rosary novena. This case comes from Mississippi, and speculation right now is rife that this could be the case that overturns Roe versus Wade, and even Casey versus Planned Parenthood. Roe, of course, It's the companion case to Doe v. Bolton, if you remember. It was back in 1973, the case that allowed abortion to be done in all 9 months of pregnancy in our country. And Casey, that particular case put limits on Roe, but even though it recognized Roe was bad law, and everybody says that, right? You speak to any legal scholar or analyst, Roe is bad law. It still doesn't do anything to protect the lives of the unborn. So Dobbs, here's just trying to give you a thumbnail of what's happening here, a quick snapshot. Dobbs is based on a Mississippi law that bans abortion after 15 weeks. And according to both Roe and Casey, that law shouldn't be allowed to exist. Why? Well, it places an undue burden on women who are trying to exercise an alleged, let me underline, highlight, and make bold, alleged constitutional right. Right, that seven justices say that they found in the emanations and the penumbras of the Constitution. I'd like to see where that is. Bottom line, in other words, they think, look, it's there somewhere. It's somewhere there in the intentions of the writer of the Constitution. I just can't quite put my finger on it, but it's there. So, of course, there's no such thing. There isn't. And even someone like the late, you know, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that Roe is bad law. I mean, look, we know how Ginsburg ruled and where she was. She even said Roe is bad law. So, look, I'm almost convinced that Roe is going to fall. Dobbs is going to give the court the opportunity to correct what I think is a grave injustice. And if you look at the competition of the composition of our court, I would hope. This is how it's going to shake out. I would tend to think, tilt a little more conservative, a little bit more pro-life. Whether or not that happens, who knows? I mean, you need a crystal ball, I guess. I mean, I can't divine the future. Ed Wayland is a distinguished senior fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and he holds the EPPC's Antonin Scalia Chair in Constitutional Studies, which is appropriate. He actually served as a clerk for the late justice, and we've invited him here today to give us some perspective on what is coming, how it may all shake out. Ed, thank you for your time. Always good to have you here.
Thank you, Drew. Great to be with you.
So I was reading Ross Douthat. He's a New York Times columnist and recently said that, look, this could turn into a partial victory where, you know, court limits abortion to the first trimester, doesn't eradicate it altogether. Let's start there, right? Let's see what the potential compromise in middle ground is. Let's say they do that. What would happen? Would that be a victory? Would it be a partial one? Or would it be a defeat?
Well, look, that would be a terrible result. We are at the point now, for the first time in three decades, where we have an opportunity to overturn Roe and Casey in their entirety. And a result that would instead entrench a constitutional right to abortion during the first trimester would basically ensure that 95% or so of the abortions that are taking place will continue to take place. Indeed, have in mind that many women delay their abortions because there's no existing deadline, so there'd be an incentive to make sure it gets done earlier. So it might well be, especially if there's some sort of health exception thereafter, that a right to abortion during the first trimester would ensure that anyone could get an abortion. So look, that's not what this case should achieve. This case should bury Roe and Casey once for all and restore to the American people the ability to protect the lives of the unborn.
So give me your personal take. I know you can't divine the future either, but the court looks conservative. There's a number of Catholics on it. How do you think this will shake out? Which way do you think the court will tilt? And what do you think will ultimately happen with the Dobbs case?
Well, look, the court surely should overturn Roe. It doesn't matter that the justices are Catholic. It's not a matter of imposing one's Catholic views to recognize that the Constitution does not speak to this question. Indeed, for better or worse, a ruling that restores this matter to the states would allow the states to enact permissive abortion laws, and many undoubtedly would do so. So I'm very hopeful that we have six justices who will overturn Roe and Dobbs. Roe and Casey. But have in mind that there's a great deal of pressure on them, threats, subtle and not so subtle, and they're going to take a lot of heat. I clerked for Justice Scalia 30 years ago when Planned Parenthood versus Casey was argued and decided. It was thought then that we had a court that would that was ready to overturn Roe, and you know, instead you had three justices, all Republican appointees, who joined in a joint opinion that was notorious for its bombastic celebration of the right to abortion. So I look, I'm not going to be in the prediction game. I just think that I'll say that this has to be done here. This is the opportunity. If not now, it's difficult to see when it will ever happen.
So you clerked, of course, for Justice Scalia. How do you think he would have voted on this?
Well, there's no question. I mean, he was, you know, he made clear back in Casey and all along that Roe was illegitimate. And I have no question that he would stick to that here. That said, the only justice on the court now who has actually expressed an opinion on this matter, an opinion that is against Roe, is Justice Thomas. More recent appointees of Republican presidents have not had occasion to speak squarely to this question.
Well, a man who I have tremendous respect for, pray one day we'll make it to the Supreme Court, Professor Robert George, you know, Princeton's jurisprudence professor. He's calling a 6-3 decision to overturn Roe. That's what he has said. I don't know. Is there any guarantee that Justice Roberts and Kavanaugh will vote to overturn it, or even Justice Barrett? I mean, again, you're not in the prediction game, but that's how Professor George sees it shaking down. I hope he's right, because if that's the case, well, go ahead. I'll let you respond.
Yeah, well, there's no guarantee as to anyone, but when one looks at these justices' jurisprudential commitments, one sees that they should regard themselves as duty bound to do this in this case. So I sure hope that Professor George turns out to be right. I'm hoping very much for the same 6-3 result that he predicts. Indeed, you know, if some of the liberals were true to their principles, have in mind Justice Breyer is famous for saying we ought to look to foreign law, the laws of Europe, to decide what the Constitution means. Well, Mississippi's 15-week ban is more permissive than most abortion laws in Europe. So Justice Breyer himself ought to say that this law is constitutionally permissible.
Hey, yesterday there was speculation the Supreme Court was going to say something regarding the Texas heartbeat law. Where does Texas's heartbeat law come into play in all of this now? I mean, people were expecting some sort of decision on that yesterday. Didn't come. Put that into perspective, if you could.
Well, it's very interesting. The court dramatically expedited briefing and argument in that case, and I think some of the justices were eager to have an order out the very week the case was argued. The fact that it's now been more than 3 weeks suggests that they've recognized that the legal issues there, which turn more on complicated questions of what we lawyers call, you know, federal courts issues, you know, more difficult to resolve than they might have thought initially. But what you have in the Texas case is you have the Texas Heartbeat Act that essentially bans abortion after 6 weeks, in clear conflict with Roe and Casey, but with a enforcement mechanism that the court hasn't been able to figure out how to interfere with. And we've had now nearly 3 months of operation of the law in Texas with many abortions not taking place because of this law. And so I think, this ought to be a sign that the post-Roe world is one that we can adapt to and make work, though it's going to obviously involve some dramatic changes, including, you know, making sure that we provide the resources to pregnant women in need.
Amen to that. So much still to do. We know that still is time to pray, and hopefully next week when they look at this, their minds will be illuminated, their hearts convicted, and the right decision will be made. Ed, thank you for your time. I'm grateful for it. Enjoy your Thanksgiving, okay? Thanks for being here with us.
You too. Thank you.
And it's Ed Whalen, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. I'll be right back. Stay with me. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans,
Visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
This is such a good show.
Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
I was just saying to Maggie, that's such a good tune. I never get tired of hearing it. That song, I'm sure, how many times have you heard it? I mean, so many times. Just good sound. I love it. Hey, it's good to be with you today. Coming up in about 30 minutes, we'll pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. You know, we were talking a little bit about life just a moment ago, the Dobbs case and Texas heartbeat bill, and there's so many different battles going on. It's the preeminent issue of our day, right? And it's not going away. I mean, even if Roe v. Wade gets overturned, and we're going to see battles, you know, come down to the states. But, you know, I think if we take the politics out of this, we take the states out of this, we take even abortion out of this, right? Sister Lucia DeSantis, I've been saying this over and over again. I was so struck by her statement to Cardinal Caffara when she did her interview with him, talking about how the final confrontation is going to be over family and marriage. It's over life, right? And it's not just what's happening in abortion clinics. It's not just happening, you know, as I said, in the halls of Congress with their funding or anywhere else. You know where it's happening? It's happening in the homes. I came across something, and I bet this will hit home with you. I know several people who are young who just don't want to have kids, and I never heard anything of it. I have 5 kids, right? My wife and I, we got married, and in year one, we had our first. 13 months later, we had our second practically. They call them Irish twins, right? It's September 3rd and September 23rd. We had like 5 kids in just under 6 years. Thank God for that. I wish I would have had 10. I wish I had 12 if God would have given them to me. But God blessed me with children. And I tell my own children, you know, they'll be your greatest blessing. Be open to life. You know, kids are your greatest blessings. People worry about their finances in the home and the car and what. That stuff's so fleeting and passing. It's the gift of life. It's the greatest gift. It really is. American apathy right now towards children is growing. And this is really, I don't want to be so negative. Gosh, this is a bad sign. All right, I'll be honest with you. It is. It's just not a good indicator. And it's probably, you know, it could just be apathy. I don't think so. I don't think that's the right word for it. Bottom line is, I saw a study that said the fewer Americans want to have children. Fewer Americans, they want to have kids. Now, let me ask you about that. What about your own family? What about your kids or their kids or your nieces or nephews? Maybe you're listening, you're saying the same thing. You know, 2 and done, or 1, or hey, 0, I want none. There was a recent Pew Research survey that found that 44% of adult Americans in their childbearing years say, well, not likely we're going to have kids ever. Not even 1, not even 2, not the little boy and the girl, and that's it, and we're happy and done. No, they don't want to have any kids. In fact, I have a nephew who makes pretty good money. He's got a good career, and he said that to me too. I said, when are you going to have kids? I'm not going to have kids. I said, why not? Nah, I don't want kids. You know, and I'm shocked. You know, it comes from a great Catholic family, comes from a big family, and he doesn't want kids. To me, that's a serious problem because the U.S. fertility rate is already at its lowest point in our nation's history. I look at the Muslim replacement rate. I've talked about this number. Muslims the replacement rate is 8.1. Here in the States, in order to have a stable economy, a stable nation, you need at least 2.1 children per family, right? We're at the lowest point in our nation's history. So while the world looks on, this is actually a good thing because they believe, you know, there are already too many people on the planet. It's part of this great deception that we have in our time. I think it's evil. I do. I think Satan has cast this great lie and the world has bought it. You know, oh, you're overpopulated. How long have we heard that, right? Too many people on the planet. So it means that more women now are getting educated and they're also becoming more well off. I think finances and wealth, I think that has a lot to do with this too. It's, you know, what's going to happen is going to end up being a disaster. When you don't have babies, your population ages, and it means there are fewer people to support that aging population. But one other stat here, and I'm going to be talking just a moment to Don Fetter. He's going to be stopping by, and we'll talk about this. I'd love to hear about your own experience, too, so feel free to join me. There's another interesting stat from this report that I saw, and let me throw this number at you. 56% of non-parents, 56% of non-parents say they simply don't want to have babies. They cited this, and here's the reasons, okay? One, it's the state of the world. They cited the state of the world. I don't want to bring kids up in this world. Two, climate change, right? And then there was a whole litany of other factors, too. But there's a fear. There's a real fear of what the future holds. And that fear is driving a factor in the push for euthanasia. So this is not just about the beginning of life. It's also about the end of life. And fear is not from God. You know, the one who prays does not fear the future, Our Lady said. You know, the one who prays does not fear the future. We have no God. This is the problem. Here's a bottom line, my own personal opinion here. We have banished God from our lives, from our schools, from our educational institutions, from our government, you know, from every sector of our culture. You know, we see the even big tech health censors, people of faith. When you reject God societally, when you reject him personally, there's consequence. And that's, you know, what fills the gap, what fills the void? Fear, right? You find reliance and security in wealth, which is fleeting, you know? It's fear that's driving this. That's my personal opinion. It's the rejection of God, which plays a role in this. It's a demonic deception. It's all part of why, you know, we have this anti-life spirit that has invaded the culture right now. China's also facing a similar problem. It's not just the U.S. The government there, you know, they've had that one-child policy, and then they reversed its policy. They limit the number of children now to two, right? They had the two-child policy. Russia is incentivizing its women to have children, paying them $10,000 to get pregnant. I mean, you see nations that have had this policy about limiting, you know, fertility, and how it's coming to destroy the nation. A little too late for China. What the Chinese authorities didn't count on was the apathy that would set into their population, an apathy very similar to the attitudes Americans now have, and it's connected to material prosperity. You know, when a nation grows wealthy like this, it's funny, instead of being open to life and having more children and saying, wow, isn't this wonderful? What a blessing. I can feed them. I can clothe them. I can educate them. Suddenly people want to hold on to their money, and kids, oh, too expensive to raise a kid today. Can't do it. Right? So I think finances, we reject a God and we worship a different one. We worship the God of mammon. We worship materialism. We worship prosperity. Now, I think all of this is so connected. But here to look at the numbers, and you can join me too. Our number, 888-914-9149, is Don Fetter. He was a columnist for the Boston Herald, New England's second largest newspaper. Did that for almost two decades. And after leaving the Herald, he has served as a communications consultant for various pro-life and pro-family and non-governmental groups and organizations. Right now, he's the coalition director and the director of communications for the Ruth Institute. They're a great organization. Check them out at ruthinstitute.org. And, Dodd, it's great to have you back with me. Good afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me, Drew. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, let's talk about what we're seeing here, because this is troubling. The population control lobby, if you will, they see this as a great success, right? We see young kids. I've talked to 20-some-year-olds who just don't want to have kids. You saw the same data that I did. Put it into perspective, what happens when we start losing population? And in addition to that, maybe give us some perspective on why this attitude right now is becoming more pervasive, that they don't want to have children.
Well, we have, I think, worldwide, we're now above replacement fertility. Fertility replacement, Drew, as I'm sure you know, is about 2.1. The average woman has to have 2.1 children in the course of her life, just to replace current population. In the United States, right, by the way, we're below that. We're now about 1.78. Right. Not as low as the European Union, but low enough so that we're going to begin losing people. By losing people, I mean the population will begin to decline. It's hard to say where the end is going to be. You know the old expression, will the last one to leave the room turn out the lights? It could very well come to, you can't, Drew, and again, I'm sure you're aware of this, you can't maintain an advanced industrial civilization without people.
That's
you know, you can always find more natural resources. You can find ways to combat pandemics and, you know, other natural disasters. Without people, eventually you're going to die.
No, I agree.
Sometime in this century, the Earth's population will begin declining. And, of course, when you have fewer and fewer children, those fewer children will themselves have fewer children until eventually there aren't enough people to maintain a civilization. That may seem alarmist or sound alarmist, but that's the reality of it.
You know, I could not agree with you more. Yeah, it's a slow death is what it is. People don't see it coming, but you're absolutely right. I'm going to take a few calls. If you're on hold, I'll get to you. It's 888-914-9149. If you're just joining me, we're taking a look at some new data that is out showing that Americans are choosing not to have children. I just want to look down the road and around the bend and what that portends for the future of this great nation. You know, we have the resources in this nation to support an aging population right now. But, you know, if we're not going to procreate, who knows what that happens? I think about Japan. You know, population should look like a pyramid. You know, the most elderly at the very top of the pyramid and the young, very vast, of a strong, wide base. In Japan, that pyramid's inverted. And China, of course, is considered the model for controlling population. Let's talk China for a moment. What's really going on there right now? What are they seeing as a result of this policy? I know they have a gender imbalance. They have more males than they do females right now. But what's happening as a result of their decades-long policy?
China, if the current trends continue, China is going to lose half of its population by the end of this century. In other words, they'll go from, I think, 1.3 billion... to less than 600 million. Now, you say that to people, and you know they look at you like you're crazy. They say, what are you talking about? China's the largest nation on Earth. Yes, it is today. But China managed to ruin their fertility rate. They managed to get people so used to not having children that they can't change the mindset today.
Yep.
You know, eventually China, like Russia, is going to offer incentives for people to have children. That really doesn't work. People have to want to have children. And in order for people to want to have children, you said this earlier, Drew, you have to have faith. Faith is the driving force behind procreation. And we can talk about how we manage to destroy our fertility rate. People aren't getting married young. They're getting very much older. For a lot of people, there's a desire not to have children. And they camouflage that by saying, oh, I don't want to bring children into this world. You know, there's global warming. There's COVID. Yeah. That's nonsense. These are simply excuses. They don't want to have children because they're selfish. By selfish, I mean their life is centered on self. The only way we can get away from that is to get back to lives that are centered on God.
Amen to that. I couldn't agree more. You know, a lot of excuses too. Oh, student loan debt's so high, and you know, I can't afford to have kids right now. Yeah, a lot of different excuses being made for this. But when we come back, I'll tell you what. I'm going to take a short break. Let's take some calls. We'll talk more. Americans are choosing not to have children. How did we get here? And what does it portend for the future? Love to hear your own experience as well. We'll be back right after this. Stay with us. Hi, Drew Mariani here. Hey, I am traveling to the Holy Land in February with our underwriting sponsor, Nativity Pilgrimage. Information is available at relevantradio.com/Holy Land. That's relevantradio.com/Holy Land.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we will pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Tell one other person, have them join you today, especially if that family member needs prayers or the business is in trouble or the court case is looming. We can all gather together and ask God for his mercy and intercede for each other. If you're on hold, I'm going to go right to the phones. My guest today, Don Federer, we're talking about Americans choosing not to have children. Look, we are in a battle for life in this country. I talked about the Dobbs case. That'll be a very significant Supreme Court case coming up next month. And this is something that we're going to see. And as I said, look, this is not just about what's happening in the courts or the funding that comes out of our federal government. This really comes down to you, the individual, your openness to life, your trust in God, the recognition of life as a gift. You know, it's not a right to have a child. It's a blessing. It's a privilege. It's a gift. It's a gift from God. I hope you'll be open if you're considering not having children, putting them off for finances or something else. I remember my grandmother when I was having all these kids year after year after year, and I was getting a little worried, to be honest with you. I was thinking, how am I going to pay? How am I going to feed these kids, right? The Lord always provided. And my grandmother had this old saying. She says, God will always provide a loaf of bread for you, Drew, to feed your children. I mean, for every child God gives you, he'll provide a loaf of bread, I think is the saying that she said. Meaning, God will always provide. He'll give you the needs. He'll take care of what you need. And it was true. I have great stories of his providence in my life, and there's great stories of providence probably you've experienced as well. Let's jump into the phones. If you want to check out Don Federer, he hails from the Ruth Institute, and he currently is the director of communications, the coalition's director there, the ruthinstitute.org. Don, let's go to Todd in Kentucky. He's been waiting to join the conversation. Todd, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. I was reading an essay in the Catholic Thing the other day. David Bonagura had written this one, and he was talking about the last acceptable prejudice. And it was not the Catholic Church, but it was having large families. Yeah. He had six children himself, and he was talking about the hostility of people toward folks with large families. And, of course, one of the things he mentioned was that people would say, having fewer children reduces the carbon footprint and so on and so forth. But even Catholics in his own parish would look at him and say, are these, or the lady at the checkout would say, are these all yours? Or somebody at church would look at him and they would start counting the children he was talking about the hostility from outside toward people who have large children, large numbers of children. I've got four, and they're all grown, all but one. Yeah. And I think that's I hear more and more about people who experience that sort of hostility.
You know why, Todd?
Because they have several children.
I've got a theory on it, because I've been on the receiving end of that. I mean, when you have five kids and they're all within like 6 years, I mean, beautiful family, right? We were young. We had these beautiful kids. Even my neighbor who lived next to me at the time, when I was living in the state of Pennsylvania, oh, you're pregnant again. Don't you know how this happens? I mean, they'd make comments like that. And just, I heard many of the same comments you've already voiced. You know what I think it is? I tend to believe when people see a family that's open to life like that, it pricks their conscience. You know, it makes them feel guilty because they may have closed the door for life. And look, in their heart, they know that children are a blessing and a gift. I worked with a couple that only had two children. And they've often said to me, they said, look, that's the greatest mistake we've made. We limited our family because we were building our business. We were working on this. We didn't think we could afford more. They had all these excuses. And now that their kids are raised and gone, they realized, wouldn't it be a blessing in the end of your life to have a much larger family? I think people's consciences are pricked because they're contracepting or they're not open to life. And they see the beauty of that family. But let me bring Don into the conversation too, Todd. Thank you for your call. Don, I'd love your thoughts on that. What do you think?
Oh, I think you're right, Drew. I think for some people there's a feeling of guilt, and for others there's hostility because they've been brainwashed into thinking that more people means less resources for everyone else. It means that eventually, you know, we're going to go back to the Dark Ages. Obviously, that's nonsense. But, you know, you said it's not just Catholics, Drew, and you're right. I read an article by an Orthodox rabbi who said he was out with his wife and their five children, and there was a woman in a supermarket who came up to the rabbi and his wife and began berating them for having five children.
Wow. My wife and I often said, how rude. I mean, who to somebody and say that? Mind your own business. You know, I mean, mind your own business. Roy in Madison, good afternoon. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Don Fetter.
Hi, Drew. Hi, Don. This just really hit my button when you start talking about it, Drew. Because, you know, my daughter has given us two beautiful grandkids. Both go to Catholic school here in Madison. And our son was a teacher for 18 years in public school in Madison. He couldn't take it anymore, Drew, about a year ago, and had to get out of it because it's so out of control, public school, public education. And that's why he's not going to have, he said, all this stuff coming down the pike that we're seeing, these out of control kids, the schools and their gender, they don't know what, and they teach them to be like this. Don't tell your parents what it, he said he saw this coming. That's why he couldn't take it anymore. He had to get out of public education. And that's why he said he can't have kids. He won't bring them into it, Drew. And we pray. And he's a good Christian kid, good Christian boy. And we say, that's the wrong attitude, you know?
You're right,
but
Roy.
You're right.
I couldn't agree more. And, Don, this is something you look at a lot, I know, at the Ruth Estate, the indoctrination of kids, the sexual things that are being taught to kids. And you can understand the fear that some parents have when they see this this dysfunction, both in culture, but especially in the world of academia right now. They don't want to expose their kids. So I don't think it's a good, you know, excuse, Roy, as I know neither do you. As parents, we're primary educators of our children, and you have to make sure that if the schools aren't going to do the job, you've got to do the job. But, Don, I'll let you respond to that as well. You know, I'm sure you're seeing a lot of this in our schools and other places. Roy's kids aren't alone.
Certainly. You know, the schools today, including private schools, including, in some cases, Catholic schools, teach sexuality education. Now, that's not like sex education as it was in my day. You know, here's how to prevent disease. You know, here's what happens when this and this combine. It's changing people's attitudes. I mean, today, one of the big things, of course, is transgenderism. If you're a boy who thinks you're a girl, then you are a girl. And, of course, vice versa, if you're a girl who thinks you're a boy, you're a boy, which is absolute nonsense. And these, by the way, are the people who are always telling us to follow the science. Yeah. Well, you know, scientifically, if you're born a boy, regardless of what you do to yourself, you'll be a boy until the day you die.
That's right.
I mean, the nonsense that's being crammed in people's heads. By the way, I would have thought that the Virginia governor's race would have begun to turn this around, but it hasn't. There was an article, an op-ed, I think, on the NBC website about why parents shouldn't be telling teachers what to teach.
Yeah.
It's insane.
You know, liberal media and even, you know, the Democrats who, you know, they're going to face a midterm election. And this should have been a real warning to them, but instead they're doubling down. They tend to think they know better than what parents know when it comes to the education of their children. I think it's a poison pill. Yeah, I think it's going to be a hard lesson learned. I'm with you. I'm quite surprised that after, you know, what we saw happen. I mean, here you've got McAuliffe in the lead by multiple points. You've got this underdog not only come back but take a decisive lead. Parents have a voice, and they let it be known. And we'll see that not just in Virginia. You're going to see that in states all across the union. Andrew in Dodge County, Wisconsin. I have about 2 minutes, so you got to make your comment quickly. Good afternoon.
Well, if you want to find out what happens to a country when the population goes down, study Ireland after the potato famine and the Great Immigration. Ireland was a really thick population before the famine, and man, oh man, after all the people died and a lot of them went to America, Ireland was in poverty for a long, long, long time. And, you know, you'd... real estate dropped and everything dropped. There were no customers in stores, and would urge both of you to study up on it.
I appreciate it. Hey, Andrew, thank you. I got to leave it at that point in time because I'm out of time. But you're right. I mean, history has a lot of lessons to teach us. I'm going to give you final thoughts, Don. You got about 30 seconds.
Yes, I would suggest that people go to our website. We have an information page, a fact page on demographic winter, which is what the disaster of population decline is called by some of us who are fighting it. Look, we have some wonderful articles. We have statistics. We have ideas for reversing these trends. The only advice I can give is gird yourself for the battle ahead.
All right, I got to leave it right there. Don, thank you. Always a delight having you
here. My pleasure.
Here.
Thank you, Drew.
You got to stay with me. I'll be right back. We will pray the chaplain.